And that's very
it's a local tan this time, not just a world tan.
Except Gerald went down again.
August 6th is the 40th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, and I'd like to start out the day by reading something that many of you are probably familiar with. In the early morning of August 1945, the United States Army weather observation plane took off from Tinian Air Base toward the Japanese interior. As the plane neared Hiroshima City at an altitude of 10,000 meters, it sent a message to the B-29 Enola Gay, which was following it. I read this last night. I sat and went through this entire book that was compiled by the Japanese after the bombing of Hiroshima, and I was so moved. I dreamt about it all night long, I'm just terrified reading it. I'll try again. The people in the city were on their way to work. At 7 a.m., workers had started tearing down buildings as part of the city's self-defense measures, and many volunteers and students who had come from both inside and outside the city were at work in the open. When the air raid alert was called off, there was a brief moment of relief among these people. It did not last long. At 8:15 a.m., the whole city was instantaneously covered with a bluish-white glare. The Enola Gay, together with two weather observation planes, invaded the skies of Hiroshima from the northeast and released the atomic bombs at 8:15 a.m. at an altitude of 9,600 meters. The atomic bomb exploded 43 seconds later. Records on the time of the explosion vary from 8:15 to 8:18 a.m. With the explosion of the atomic bomb, the epicenter instantaneously reached a maximum temperature of several million degrees centigrade, an atmospheric pressure of several hundred thousand bars. With the formation of a fireball, powerful heat rays and radiation were emitted in all directions within a short interval. Radiation extended not only directly from the burst point, but also from the surface of the ground, from fission fragments and the residue of neutron-induced radioactive materials. The shock waves propagated by the explosion and the tremendous blast that followed almost instantaneously demolished buildings and killed 100,000 people. Those survivors suffered the agonies of thermal burns and radiation exposure, whose effects were in many cases delayed. And from a book that went with it is The Children of Hiroshima, an illustration drawn by a woman an adult, and the picture says there's a soldier examining a skull. The woman says, "My army friend took up the 7 skeletons, one at a time, his 5 children, his wife, his mother, and each time stared at the sky. We soldiers were the ones who were supposed to die." So, every year, we're reminded of a lesson we've never learned. I can't even light it. Could someone light it? I had nightmares all my life. There you go, very good with that. Somehow the impact of reading these 2 books brought home again and again the message that we need to learn. And one of the things that we're going to be thinking about today with a great deal of concentration is remembrances of war and how it has affected our lives. And
we're going to sing the song that's up on the window there. And each line is repeated twice. And after many colored people, then you always sing, "Singing for Our Lives." And so you, Mary, sing the first verse once, and then we'll start over again with you joining in.
Band played Waltzing Terrible.
Play a little louder. I think enough of you know what it is.
Thank you.
short things, remembrances of war. The first is from a piece that I remember from public television, Testament of Youth, was serialized, and this is from the introduction. The book itself was written by a woman who lived this experience. The preface is written by her daughter and her daughter's impressions of her mother. So it's an interesting preface in that regard. The preface begins, "It is now 60 years since the First World War ended, and few are still alive who survived that fearful experience at first hand. The war should now be a part of history. The weapons, the uniforms, the static horror of battles fought in trenches are now obsolete. Yet the First World War refuses to fade away. It has marked all of us who were in any way associated with it, even at one generation's removed through our parents. The books, the poetry, the artifacts of those 4.5 years still speak to young men and women who were not even born when the Second World War ended. Why are we so haunted? I think it is because of the terrible irony of the war, with capital letters, the idealism and the high-mindedness that led boys and men in their hundreds of thousands to volunteer to fight and often to die, the obscenity of the square miles of mud, barbed wire, broken trees and shattered bodies into which they were flung, battalion after battalion, and the total imbalance between the causes for which the war was fought on both sides as against the scale of the human sacrifice. As Wilfred Owen put it in the send-off, shall they return to beatings of great bells in wild train loads? A few, too few for drums and yells. There is another reason, too. The First World War was a culmination of personal war. Men saw the other human beings they had killed, visibly dead. Men fought with bayonets, with knives, or even their bare hands. The guns themselves were on the battlefields, thick with smoke. The gunners sweaty and mud-bound. War had not yet become a pitting of scientist against scientist or technologist against technologist. Death was not, on either side, elimination through pressing a button, but something seen and experienced personally, bloody, pathetic, and foul. My own picture of the war was gleaned from my mother. Her life, like that of so many of her contemporaries who were actually in the fighting or dealing with its consequences, was shaped by it and shadowed by it. It was hard for her to laugh unconstrainedly. At the back of her mind, the row upon row of wooden crosses were planted too deeply. Through her, I learned how much courage it took to live on in service to the world when all of those one loved best were gone. First, her fiancé, her best friend, her beloved only brother. The only salvation was work, particularly the work of patching and repairing those who were still alive. After the war, the work went on, writing, campaigning, organizing against war. My mother became a lifelong pacifist. I still remember her in her 70s, determinedly sitting in a CND demonstration and being gently removed by the police. The other... When I was traveling a lot last year, or the year before, going from place to place, I spent a lot of time in airports. And this is a book I picked up in an airport, and I probably would never have read any other time, but I'm real glad I did. It's called Everything We Had, and it's direct reminiscences of 33 Vietnam vets. And the last one is, I'd like to show you just a portion of the last one. This fellow is Stephen Klinkhammer, and I read this part first, and then I went back to see where he was from. He's from Wisconsin, and he served as a corpsman on an aircraft carrier, the Midway, and his section is called the Fall of Saigon, but he's later remembering the war itself. It's a dull pain, you know, just a whole lot of knowledge that I think I've gained, and I think I've grown from it. And I have to deal with that maturity, too, in myself. I grew up real fast. I mean real fast. It seems like a whole block of my life that I can't account for, and I want to find that block because I know it's important. I have a certain pride, too, because I was a damn good medic. I have problems with that. I think a lot of times that it's my fault, and that it's not my fault. There is no blame. The actual emotions are a fact. I'm a fresh veteran. He's writing 5 years after the war. I'm really not that old. I'm 25. I'm just out. And there's still a lot of things that I'm real close to in there. A lot of that system I didn't mind, but people I know say, Steve, forget it, it's over. But the last thing I need is pity. The last thing I need is for someone to feel sorry for me. My mother told my brother, let Steve alone, he's not the same anymore. This was after my first tour in Nam. I guess I was changed and didn't know it. You're the last person to see yourself change. And the fact that you're not going to get any pats on the back, you're not going to get a parade, you're not going to get anything but misunderstood. And I still feel that sometimes. Maybe I could have done better. People want me to bury it. I can't bury it. I did learn something. I'm not sure what it was. I know it's affected me a whole lot, and I think it's a good way. And I think I've grown from that because I don't want to see it ever happen again. And I really care about people. I really care to try to help people to work through problems of their own. What we'd like to do today is gather some reminiscences of how the effects of war have influenced you, your own lives, and what your thoughts are about it. And we'd like to gather these together and print them up so that they can be passed on to the Youth of Prairie for discussion. And what we thought we'd do is first start out with a little discussion to figure out if you can offer any suggestions or any of your own reminiscences, and then in a few minutes we'll pass out some papers and you can spend maybe 15 minutes or so writing down your impressions. There are two questions. Does anyone have anything they'd like to offer as a remembrance of the times? Either things that you experienced through yourself or through your parents or other friends or relatives. Maybe I'd like to start off. Maybe some of you don't know that I was 5 years a military spouse, an Air Force spouse, and my association with war, Vietnam War, is post-Vietnam, and to me, war means drug abuse. It doesn't have a lot of any other direct meaning to me except a tremendous amount of drug abuse and mental problems, because those are the people that my husband worked with. In Thailand and on the bases in the United States. So I saw a lot of the remains of the war and the living dead. Any other remembrances of war?
I was thinking about something the other day. I'm taking a course this summer in bilingual education, and there are a lot of people in the class who are tri or even quadrilingual, and one person said something about the language German. She said she'd always thought of it as a very harsh language. And she lived in Germany, and by choice, and hoped to go back. But she was making a value judgment, and one of the things we're being taught in this course is to try not to. And what I thought of was that I can remember when I thought that about German, too. And since that time, I've done a lot of singing in German, and I've heard people sing very beautifully in German, and I realized that my feelings about it as a harsh language came from other places than languages, because I'm a linguist and I like all the languages I study. German doesn't happen to be one of them. It didn't. And I realized that the age from about 7 to 12, when I went to movies every Saturday, was all war propaganda movies. I didn't think of them as propaganda at the time. I thought of them as our side winning, which is a little different. But they were, it took me a long time to learn that not all Japanese threw babies out and caught them on bayonets, and not all Germans spent their lives marching around in boots and funny hats that turned up, saying Achtung in a very guttural way, of course. And I realized that although these had been, you know, really westerns, cowboy westerns turned into war films, as far as the plot went, that I'd been slowly but thoroughly brainwashed to believe a lot of things about Japanese and German and more latterly Italian people that I carried with me all my life, well past the point where I would and should and could have known better, and that those things were still there to be nudged out one by one and dealt with. And unless I did, sometimes not even knowing they were there, they would not be dealt with, and I would hold them as concepts and therefore prejudices all my life. And that was pretty scary.
Recollection that I have is something just as a child, as a personal thing, but I think it had a big impact in our overall family. Both of my folks are physicians, and my mother and one other elderly physician were the only ones left in the county, up in the Lake County. During the war, my father and all the other physicians were off tending the war injured, and he was over in Belgium and what has it. So I grew up waking up in the middle of the night and screaming and hollering because I'd hear my mother going out on a house call. They did that in those days. And then she'd come home and I'd scream and holler and she'd have to come in and soothe me. So there was part of that was the fact that it meant that, you know, that influenced the thing. But the big thing was that at age 5, I'm 44 now, so 1941, this strange man walked in, bold as you please, in my back door. I'm standing there in the kitchen, just like he knew what he opened like. And walked in, took over, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night, tiptoeing down the hall and looking in my mother's bedroom, and there was that same man. And I thought, years later, and there was a strangeness there, you know, just because of that separation. And you think about it, that that's what wars do so often, and prolonged separations like that. So all that bonding with the little girl to the daddy and all that kind of thing, you never had any of those chances. And so a whole group of us, you know, that was, and there was the post-war baby boom, and that whole effect, you know, that all these kids come along here, as I have three younger ones, and they got all the attention. And but I got shortchanged. I didn't get a certain part of my childhood.
I'm second world war vintage. Growing up in New York City, listening to the shortwave and hearing Hitler. And across the shortwave, the crackly shortwave, and I can still, I mean, I'm feeling these goosebumps from top to bottom because it came through across all those miles, what a crazy man this was. And the roaring of the crowd, Heil Hitler, frightened us. Also, of course, being Jewish made it more important. But before that even, my uncle and cousin and aunt lived in Manchuria. And so when Japan invaded Manchuria, there was this talk. Now, of course, as a child, you know, it's all adults over your head, but you capture that feeling of fear and worry about your family all the way across the world. And then Ethiopia being invaded by Italy, all of these things, and then great, in school, great discussions about the Finns and the Russians, and people were on one side or the other. And then knitting scarves for the Royal Air Force before we were in the war ourselves, and I was so proud. That's when I learned to knit, and it grew, you know, yards and yards and yards, but I felt that I was doing my part. And also rolling bandages for the Red Cross. And then of course, I'll never forget Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. I was brushing my teeth. It was Sunday morning, and my father was, the radio, the news was always on. And the world changed, and then there were air raid. There were you had to douse the lights. Of course, we had the blackout curtains and so on. There were the air raid wardens patrolling, and it was just incessant. Oh, won't the world war ever end? And all of these reports, and it was just on and on and on. And by the time it was over, I was out of high school and working in a map-making firm. And we were preparing maps. We weren't supposed to know where they were. But I was called a paste-up girl, and we cut out little squares of soundings. We're putting them over this was before computers and all those things, but you put them over the numbers so that they could photograph and so on. It was all, of course, for the invasion of China. And then the end of the war, of course, I was interested in saving and working and saving money so I could go to school in California. And somehow, when the bomb happened and the end of, and Japan surrendered.
No.
Yes. And CJ did. And I remember the tick, the, I was on Wall Street and people were throwing out bits of paper and toilet paper and everything. The joy was just fantastic. But I also remember the young woman named Stephanie who worked with us who lost her brother in the war and how crushed she was. The war was just pervaded our minds. And then going across the country on a train to go to Berkeley to school, and on the train were all the returning veterans, or many returning veterans, and how I sat with them as a young girl, really naive and inexperienced, but this sense of grimness of I've lost all this time in my life and now I'm going to get on with it. And I was in school then at the university with all of these returning veterans who had no time to play. And they were called the DARs, the damned average raisers. So if that was the effect of war on me. Just a few.
One more and then we'll start running. Jim?
I guess in a lot of ways I was lucky. No member of my family, even extended family, was ever killed in a war that I know of. My Italian heritage, avoiding wars. I guess the impact of war didn't really make itself felt on me until I spent some time in Germany in 72. A friend of mine was from an area of Germany, his ancestors were from an area of Germany that I was living in. So I went out to visit the town and I went to the graveyard out there. And all these sons that were born into a family and these pictures and everything, it really started having an impact on me. And then in the last so many years, working where I do the sort of the, and having so much knowledge of the cruelty that people have toward one another, and sort of focusing more and more on the cruelty on all levels, from the societal level, which war, the stupidity and the inhumanity of war, all the way down to sort of even within individuals, how people seem at times to be at war with themselves and the trouble there. And I guess that has made a real impact on me to the point where even songs like It's Waltzing Matilda get to me. I can't stand war movies anymore. I just, when I see the war movies now, I think of the impact on a single individual. I remember hearing a program on Nagasaki where this woman lost an arm. Japanese woman lost an arm in the war, and how she said something like, it ruined my life, it affected my whole life. And I felt that was true. I mean, on the scale of things, losing an arm isn't that great. But I'm sure for her, that happened. And I guess it's in the last so many years, especially, I've been sort of wondering, how can human beings do that to one another? How can we commit war? And I guess I feel that we need to sort of take on responsibility for it. It's not like those people commit war. I think we're all, culpable. We all participate in that. And I think we need to take a look at what it is in human beings, in our social organization, and what it is about us that can lead us to war. Lead us to these horrors. I don't think it's a sort of an easy answer, blaming on this or that or the other thing. I think there's a whole set of complex causes. And I guess that sort of is what war is to me. And it's something that has come to me sort of later in life. It's not something that I've had personal experiences for.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this. I want to talk a little bit about the refugees I'm knowing right now. There have been some recent wars and wars going on that the U.S. is not involved. On the last one, because I worked with a woman who's from Vietnam, and she and her husband came over here with their children. They left
after the fall of Saigon, she told me about leaving, climbing up into the airplane, seeing her brother shot. And it was leaving. She and her immediate family got out. For years, they wanted her mother and the rest of their family to come out. And the situation in trying to correspond or even have knowledge of what's going on is very difficult. If they send packages to Vietnam, they get searched. The person who's living there has to pay money to receive the mail. And the minute that you apply for them to come to the U.S., or they apply to leave the country, they have to quit their jobs. And it takes years and years and years to be able to get out. She's waited 7 years, but this last week her family, most of her family, finally did arrive. Her mother, who was apparently got cancer, and brothers and sisters. And I think that's kind of a happy thing, but I think there's a profound effect on many people that sometimes you're not aware of that are living here in Madison. I worked with an Afghani family who are here. There's several Afghani families that are here as refugees from the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. They're living in camps in Pakistan. This man has been tortured. He has missing fingers. There's a heavy amount of family pathology in terms of his, like a battered family, in other words, his wife is kept confined, you know, there's severe problems in terms of trying to integrate him in the community. So you have all the problems of culture shock and all the rest of it. And I guess part of me is grateful that we haven't had that experience of having to be refugees, of having to adapt to a kind of thing where we don't want to be, of never being able to go home again. I also work with a man from El Salvador. Can't stand him personally. You know, I mean, that's that situation. He says, you know, they all want to go home, and they can't go home. And, you know, I think all of our lives have been touched. But the other thing I want to mention is that there's still U.S. involvement in an area where it's never been resolved, and that's Korea. One of my brother's friends was killed in the DMZ 4 years ago. There's still many skirmishes, and there's still always all these places. And I wonder, kind of see if you open your eyes, you know, there's still current effects for people. And I'm grateful that we've at least are home.
I want to say something. And in the Soviet Union, about every two blocks, there's a memorial about the war. And there are peace signs every place. And our translator told us that every single family in the Soviet Union lost somebody. There isn't a family that didn't lose somebody in the war. And when we went to Leningrad, they took us to the cemetery where during the 900 days, there over a million 500,000 people died and were buried in mass graves. So you look down this pathway, and there are these long mounds. And in each mound, there are 1,500 to 50,000 people, 15,000 people buried in each mound. And they had to do that in order to avoid disease. The other thing that was so amazing was that the Nazis totally destroyed the palace at Petrogradsk, which was built by Peter the Great. And in 1947, the people of Leningrad went out there and rebuilt that whole palace so it's just like it was before. And I said, why did you do that when people were living in caves, there weren't any houses? And he said, because we, you know, it's a symbolic thing. We had to show that the work of the peasants and the craftsmen and the artisans could be brought back, could survive. And every place, you know, the waiters in the hotel, the people on the floor, their party thing would be, you know, peace. And I think that we don't have any concept, even though our lives were touched a little by the war, we have no concept of what it was like to be in that kind of a war.
Yeah. I have a feeling
that. Yeah. When we talk about things in the region, that's between the hits of the world, because we know that. But we have 20 million people in the Soviet Union that were killed in World War II. 20 million in the life. and see how that radiates out. They were pointing out that for every 100 soldiers going in front, only 3 return, 2 wounded for life, 1 for war. And so no wonder, one person, when I came back, had what I thought the supreme, I don't know what to call it, insensitivity over all of our peacetime defense of Democrat people. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh my God, how much of that do we have in this country? And I realized once again, then one other point, which we're not still beginning. You remember when we used to study about the Civil War, how it was to do away with slavery. And it was years and years before they finally began to come out with the truth. The causes were economic. And I think they're not as simple as Gerald is correct. They're not simply simple. But basically, they were economic. My grandfather, when I was 12 years, 11 years old, used to say, if it is to the benefit of the powerful, then it is not to the benefit of the rich. And vice versa. So I think sometimes you have to look beyond just the economic, the political conflict, but somebody makes money out of it somehow.
Do you want to make comments when we pass it?
I have 2 comments. One first one, the other is very good. One is that Vietnam damaged everybody who was around. I was one of those who was clever enough to maneuver not to go. And I feel real scarred. I changed my life around in significant ways to avoid not going. Lots of people I know left their families, ran off to Canada. You start doing fantasy trips in your head because a lot of us thought Vietnam was immoral, as I felt it was. And so you're paying taxes for it, and that was very alienating. And you were hiding out. One time my apartment I was with, my roommate was busted. He had a nickel bag in it. He had been selling a little dope, and I was terribly afraid to find out what my grad status was, because I was, at that time, illegal and would have been liable for immediate draft. And he did fantasy trips about what you would do if you got caught up in it. Would you leave the country? Would you take a grenade and blow up the officers as your moral duty? And there were all those type of things that went on in your head. And I don't think anybody who was of draftable age at that time was unscarred. There's a hell of a lot of scars. And someone said something about going home. I often make the statement that I can never go home. And sorry, I need a minute. I need to go on to the other point. I can't talk about it. I have a number of Vietnam vets that come to Red Shed, and contrary to the image of men being warful people, I can't get anyone to talk about the war. And you have people, close friend of mine had his leg blown off. He won't talk about it. My brother-in-law was shot 11 times. He won't talk about it. The point I want to make is that war is, and this is a cerebral thought, is war is the male rape experience. And that the type of things that women describe as being raped, namely a physical fear of losing their life, being a depersonalized experience and dehumanizing experience. Those are the terms I frequently hear from women when they're raped. Life-threatening, depersonalization, dehumanization. That's what happened to so many of the Vietnam vets. They went into, like, I've heard them talk a little bit. Periodically, they'll talk with each other, but it's so rare. I can get any information for those who were there. They had an M1 and an M16, they shot it wherever, because you couldn't tell the enemy from the civilian in Vietnam. And then after they went to see what they shot a woman, a child, an old person, someone who was clearly not the enemy. And they wanted to throw up on the spot, because they just blow them away, just rip the bodies apart with these weapons, they're very powerful. And there was a sense of a deadening in them. And I guess, that's what there's a sense of depersonalization. There's a sense that they had no value, that they were valueless. And there's a sense that it was a life-threatening situation, and life-threatening situations, you do all kinds of things. And that's why I say, in terms of the male experience, that it's really hard for men to be empathetic about the rape experience, because in a sense, it's not.
I think we're going to need to wind up the writing.
Okay, we have a theme.
We didn't give you a book.
This is also going to be in Prairie Fire, so if you can encourage anyone else to send in their writing, and then we're hopefully going to get it printed up for the kids to use.
You want to write more.
What we're going to do now is sing two songs and then We'll have announcements, and Dodie's going to sing afterwards if anyone is interested. The next song we're going to sing is written by Judy Small. It's called Mothers, Daughters, Wives. And she's a woman from Australia whose the song was written for her mother. And her mother saw her father, her husband, and her son go to war. And you should have a copy of it. And it's real easy to join in on the chorus.
And now you get here.
25, I think.
I'm playing in a lower key than is in the book, so for good or...
Some of us are not sopranos.
I'm playing it from a book called Songs for Peace, compiled and edited by the Student Peace Union with an introduction by Pete Seeger. And I was reading through the songs in here when I was looking at Strangest Dream. A lot of them are relevant to what we're doing today, and the book was printed in 1966. And it seems as if nothing has changed.
No, it's not gotten more than that.
Take what you can and diminish it. Joyce and I are going to be away from September 11th until about the first week in October. And usually George Calden has substituted for us on the newsletter, as you know. He's not here today, and he and Ruth do quite a bit of traveling. And I'm wondering if anybody would be interested in trying a couple of issues of Prairie Fire. And if anybody will, we will run through the whole procedure with them of the mailing and putting it together and so forth. I'd really like to hear some volunteers.
Lee, if you don't find someone else to do it, I will do it. I will be here. I have done it before, though, and if it's an opportunity kind of thing, you're thinking of somebody else. I would love this opportunity. I would seize it from them for anything.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now, that certainly shortens it. I think the process has improved considerably since I last did it. Gum labels being, instead of an address wrap, mm-hmm. being one of those things. So I think you've got it down pretty well. And I guess, do they just take it to Kinko's or someplace like that when you're not here to print it?
Or Instaprint.
Yeah.
Like that. Mm-hmm. Oh, fine. Okay. Thank you.
Easier than you thought it was going to be, right?
Sorry?
It was easier than you thought it was going to be, right?
Yeah.
Is that 2 weeks or three?
I think there'll be two issues during September.
We'll check with you about
the
lapse of time.
Fine.
Is there anything else? Dodie Stone.
Oh, this is for anyone who wants to just come around the piano afterwards. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier, which was very controversial at the time it was written and was followed up by the other side who wrote a song, I didn't raise my boy to be the only soldier.
World War One.
The only soldier.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
I remember.
Those who want to stick around.
Thank you.
I really want to.